This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Welcome to Jikoji, everyone. Thank you for driving up the hill. We are really delighted to welcome Misha Shungun Merrill to be our teacher today. Misha is a teacher in the lineage of Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, who actually was the person who brought the founder of our lineage, Kogen Chino, to America. So we are deeply related. She received Dharma transmission from Les K in 1998. Les K was one of Suzuki Roshi's disciples. And since 1993 has been the guiding teacher of Zen Heart Sangha. Alongside her Dharma teaching, Misha was also expressing wisdom and care with her work with young children at the Peninsula School in Menlo Park. I think you are retired from that.
Finally.
I still have it in the present tense from the first time I introduced her. She makes her home quite nearby, right down the hill, and where she lives with her beloved husband and beloved four-footed friends. And a thriving garden. She is not only at the heart of our writer lineage family, also a cherished friend to Jikoji and to me. And it is truly a joy and an honor to welcome her back. Thank you.
Thank you. And as you can see, because I was a teacher at an elementary middle school, I have props. It's show and tell day. It's always lovely to be here. You know, when I first started practice in 1984, which seems like yesterday, quite frankly, and most of you probably weren't even born, there was a very close relationship between the temple where I grew up, Kanando, in Mountain View, and this temple. They were actually under an umbrella organization called Bodhi, and the one in Mountain View became sort of the city center, and the one here became the country center. And my teacher, Les, ended up being the teacher in Mountain View, and Kogen Chino Roshi was the teacher here. And so there's always been a connection, sometimes not as close, but I'm hoping to rectify that. And partly because of my wonderful relationship with Nenzen Roshi, but also just because it's appropriate. I count Kogen as a teacher of mine because my tea teacher, who really in some ways was my Zen teacher, was Kogen's student as well. And so there's this funny little intermingling along the way. So first of all, I want to ask a question, and you can just show of hands. I'm just wondering, how many of you might be feeling some grief or loss or yearning or maybe a little bit of brokenness in your life right now? Just anybody? Higher so we can see. Okay. Well, not as many as I was expecting, but I'm glad for you. I was at Tassajara recently and asked this question, and every person in the room put their hand up. Because it doesn't have to be grief like I've got cancer or my mother just died. It's just the grief, the dissatisfaction, the disharmony that we experience a lot in our lives. And this is really what the Buddha meant by the First Noble Truth. Which is often, the word is dukkha, and it's often translated as the truth of suffering. But the problem with the word suffering is that it's one of those words that we can give lots of different meanings to, and it's really more accurate to translate it as unsatisfactoriness or dissatisfaction. And so the way that I always describe it, and I've probably said it here before, is that suffering or dissatisfaction is the distance between what actually is and the way we want it to be. So that could be very small. Oh, I was hoping it would be a really hot, sunny day today. Versus, I didn't want my mother to die. Right? The distance between what is and what we want. And it changes, too, because a lot of times we get what we want, like we get the big ice cream cone with all our favorite flavors, but at some point the ice cream is gone. So there's this tiny little, oh, my ice cream is gone. That's a very little distance, but we got what we wanted in the first place, but then in the end, there's this a little bit of dissonance. Human beings are very funny. I mean, think about just the weather. We have this very small zone in which we are comfortable. It's either too hot, it's too cold, it's too wet, it's too dry. It's never just right. It's the old, you know, three bears and Goldilocks syndrome, right? One bowl is too big, one is too small, and then there's the one that's just right. Right? We're always looking for that just right place. And so the problem is that we are worrying about a future that we cannot know. Or we are regretting a past that we can't do anything about. Lots of us have things in our past that we wish differently. But that was then, this is now. And many of us are looking forward to maybe finding a job or finding a partner or raising our children or taking care of our elder parents, and all of these things are in this future that we can plan for. But I don't know about you, basically whenever I do any intensive planning about the future, it never comes out the way that I thought. When I actually get to that moment, everything has changed, because of course our life is very dynamic. There is nothing permanent about it. It is always changing in every moment. So if you had a meal before you came here, that meal changed your body and has continued to change your body. All the proteins and the fats and the carbohydrates are going through your body and making repairs or being fixed into waste. Lots of things all the time happening in your body. And for the most part, we're completely unaware of them until something goes wrong. So in the bathroom that my students use on Saturday mornings, there is an altar. And when I go to offer incense to that altar, my prayer is, may all beings evacuate properly. Because, as you know, women, for instance, get urinary tract infections. I don't know if any of you have had one, but they're miserable because you cannot pee. I have an old teacher who's having a lot of urological problems. To be able to evacuate normally, to go and use the toilet and have no problem, this is, we take for granted until the day that we can't. It's the same thing when you hurt yourself. We just finished doing a one-month practice period, very intensive sitting, and the person who was going to act as my head monk broke her wrist in her dominant hand, which is her left hand, 3 weeks before we started. She could not put on her kesa, right? So she had to just wear her ragasu because she can just put that over her head. She could not do any of the instruments because it's her dominant hand, and trying to do any of those bells and things with your non-dominant unless you're used to doing it is difficult. So, she wasn't expecting that to happen, but then it did. So, okay. So the thing is, this is why we try to practice here in this moment. And as a very famous Zen master, Dogen, once said in one of the sutras, he said, the meditation, the zazen I speak of, is not meditation practice. You read that and you go, wait a minute, what? I thought that's what it was. No, the zazen I speak of is not meditation practice. It is simply the Dharma gate of joyful ease. The practice realization of totally culminated enlightenment is ease in this world. That's a big word. I would imagine that most of you have moments of ease and many moments of not ease. Simply even driving up the hill to get here. You know, I've been doing 84 for 40, no, almost 50 years. It is still not a drive of ease, because I never know when someone's going to be on the wrong side of the yellow line. And I've had many close calls. That's just the physical realm, but in the mental and emotional realm, we long and yearn for ease. It would be wonderful to wake up in the morning and no matter what was going to happen that day, you felt at ease. We long for ease from worry, from grief, from anguish, and sort of the relentlessness of things getting broken. Broken words, broken trust, broken hearts, even broken governments. So what actually can we rely upon? Can we stand upright at ease instead of sinking down to our knees in the mud of our very confusing and busy and non-cooperative world? So, as I say, for the last month, I have been sitting with my students in a zendo all day long, all week long, except for 1 week when we went to Tassajara. We folded that in. And for this practice period where we encourage everyone to do a little bit more than they normally do. So if you were coming on a Sunday, which is our Saturday, we would say, well, could you come during the week at all? Or could you come online and join us that way? Just a little extra. Or maybe you can join first thing in the morning. We have an online Zazen at 6:30. Just something to add a little bit more to your practice. So this practice period begins and ends with ceremony. There's an opening ceremony where the person who's going to act as the head monk is invited to do so, even though she's already been chosen. And the board is involved and say, please, you are a choice. And there's a script, and she says, oh, no, I'm really not capable of this. And they say, no, no, you're the one we want. And finally she gives in and says, okay. So it's all scripted. But when you're in the middle of the ceremony, it feels very intimate and warm. And you really do feel the responsibility of being asked to take this position. So at the beginning, you probably heard the han, that wooden board out there that's bonk, 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 bonk. Okay. So the han has a 15-minute, what's called a roll down. So there's 7 minutes, 5 minutes, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, something like that. And at the final roll down, we all, the procession enters and the head monk takes her place and I take my place and we do some bows and all of that. Okay, so our han outside our zendo had this 15-minute roll down. And the han is here and it's a big piece of wood just like this one, really heavy. At some point many years ago, somebody hit the hand, the mallet, so hard that the head flew off. So a friend of mine made a new mallet. And I was looking at the mallet out here. One thing is similar. It's about this big around, but mine is only about that long, and the handle is only that long. So it's a little not very well balanced. Right next to the han is a big piece of timber bamboo that had two branches cut off so that you could sit the mallet in there as a holder. So one of my other monks, thunk, 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 did the whole thing, came inside, and that was Saturday. Sunday, I'm exhausted. I'm taking a day off. Monday, we're back on schedule. And Monday night, I go and lead a group down in Menlo Park. Tuesday morning, my husband says to me, "Well, did you notice the Buddha is broken?" "What? What Buddha?" And he takes me outside. There's a statue of Buddha that's just to the right of the Han. The mallet flew off the timber bamboo and hit the Buddha right on its top knot. The amazing thing was, it did not take away the whole head. It's hollow inside. The outline of the head to here is still in place. And the head was down at the base of the statue.
Looks good.
Looks good. So at first, I'm looking at this going, oh, just a bad omen. But then all of a sudden I thought, oh, actually, this is the most amazing visual metaphor I have ever seen for body and mind dropping away, which is a very famous phrase in Zen practice. Finally gotten out of the way. Your ego self is finally given up. And then what's left? So there's the Buddha with this hollow interior, but still sitting there very serenely. I'm thinking, that's it. And this, when you think about yourself, you pretty much think about this. You think about your eyes, your ears, your nose, your tongue, your body, you know. You're not thinking of yourself as your hand or your left thigh. You're thinking of yourself as this. And this is what was lying on the ground. I thought, whoa. So when my students arrived later that day, I had to be a little bit careful because I didn't want the person who had been doing the Han to think that I was blaming her at all. I said, "The most amazing, wonderful, happy accident has happened." And I took them out and they all went, "Oh, whoa." And so we left it that way for the whole practice period. I am never giving that Buddha away.
Yeah.
That hit on the head was amazing for many reasons. For one thing, why didn't the whole top of the head come off? That would have also been an interesting metaphor, but not quite the same. It hit the top knot in just this certain way, so that the image of the head is still there, but it's hollow inside. Emptiness is inside. So there are a lot of Zen stories that talk about something like this, a hit on the head. You know, there's the one of, there's a monk who's sweeping, and a stone that he's sweeping hits a piece of bamboo and goes, thunk! And it says, and then the monk was instantly enlightened. Well, I'm pretty sure that monk was probably practicing for years and years and years. But then that sound, because he was just, there was no self there while he was sweeping, the sound went in deeply and he woke up. So Dogen, again, there's another sutra, the Fukan Zazengi, where he says, triggering awakening with a finger, a banner, a needle, a mallet, or affecting realization with a whisk, a fist, a staff, or a shout. Yeah. All of these things are things that have been used by Zen masters in the past to get your attention, to bring you right here to this moment. I wish I had been there when the mallet fell. I have no idea when it happened. But without eyes, ears, nose, or mouth, this Buddha statue now sort of represents this thing called beyond seeing and hearing. Right? Its very brokenness is proclaiming its enlightened state. we need to break, which is a good thing, because life seems intent on presenting us with things that break. So some of you may have been here the last time I read this, and if so, I apologize, but it has a phrase in it that's pretty important, and I want to share it again. There is a book by a woman named Ruth Ozeki called The Book of Form and Emptiness. It's a fiction. It's highly entertaining, but it also really is about Buddhist practice and is quite wonderful. She is a monk, actually, in the Suzuki Roshi lineage. So there's several threads, and in this thread, it's a Buddhist nun in Japan who lives at a temple with just her teacher. It's just the two of them, and they're sort of eking by. One day, when I was serving tea to my teacher, the teacup slipped off the tray and fell to the floor. It was an antique cup, very old, very beautiful, with a poem inscribed on it. My teacher had received it as a gift from his teacher, and it was his favorite teacup and very precious to him. "Ha!" I cried out when it hit the floor. My teacher looked up from his book and said, "Already broken," and went back to his book. I was very confused. Broken. And thankfully, it survived the fall to the floor, probably because there were tatami. I picked it up and examined it. I didn't find a single chip or crack. I washed it, brought it back, carefully served my teacher his tea. And when he asked me to join him, I expected him to say something about my clumsiness or to explain what he'd meant. But he didn't. He just quietly sipped his tea and gazed out into the garden as if nothing had happened. Finally, I couldn't stand it anymore. "Hojo-san, your teacup didn't break. Why did you say it was already broken?" He held up the cup and admired it. "Oh, it's quite old, you know. Maybe 200 years. It was made by Rengetsu." Then he goes off into this tangent about a real-life person named Rengetsu, who was a nun, who lost her husband, was very poor, and didn't have anyone to take care of her, so she started making tea bowls. And she was a poet, so she started writing her poems on the side. And instead of keeping the money for herself, because it got to be quite popular, she gave it all away to the poor. I listened to him impatiently. He often did this. Went off on some tangent and forgot all about my question, but this time I was determined to get an answer. He was reading the nun's poem on the side of the cup. "Ah, the world's dust swept aside here in my hermitage. I have all I need, the wind in the pines." "Hojo-san," I broke in, "the teacup isn't broken." He looked up surprised. "To me it is. It is the nature of a teacup to be broken. And that is why it is so beautiful now, and why I appreciate it when I can still drink from it." He looked at it fondly, took a last sip, and then placed the empty cup carefully back on the tray. "When it is gone, it is gone." That day, my teacher gave me a priceless lesson in the impermanence of form and the empty nature of all things. Already broken. Already broken. Already broken. Already broken. Everything, everything without exception is on its way to becoming something else. Humans, animals, trees, oak trees, redwoods, teacups, your health, friendships, even things that seem permanent, like mountains and rivers and governments, are on their way to becoming something else. When it is gone, it is gone. That is its beauty. This is not fatalism or nihilism. This is not like, well, if everything's going to break, what the hell, you know, what do I care then? No, it's not about that at all. It's the opposite. If everything is going to end up broken, we need to completely appreciate it right here, right now. Appreciate the health we got. Appreciate our parents. Appreciate our children. Appreciate our Zen teachers. Appreciate that there's a Zendo here to come to. Appreciate the fact that we have a car that got us here, that we know how to drive. Every single thing is something we can feel gratitude for. The amazing thing to me, though, and when I first read this was, how does Ruth Ozeki know that this actually happened to me? In real life, not a story. My tea teacher that I referred to earlier, being Coben's student, was 78 when I first met her. She had beautiful tea things. She would go to Gump's in San Francisco that sold antiques. And she had bought this very shallow tea bowl, not much more than that, that was 300 years old. And unfortunately, you know, we would meet every Thursday, and many times it was just me and Peg, because other tea students couldn't come every week, but I was, you know, every week. On this particular day, we usually didn't use this tea bowl for tea because centrifugal force makes it very difficult to whisk. We would often use it to hold the sweet yokan, and we had that day. So at the end of the tea ceremony, I took that out, and she had a big steel sink with no divider, just all one piece. And I put it in the far left corner. The brazier that heats the water is two parts. There's the bottom part, which has the heating element, and then there's the comma on top, which holds the water. At the end of the day, you have two iron rings, and you take the whole thing out to the kitchen. And because Peg believed that the water, because it had been in an iron pot, was good for her health, she wanted us to pour it into the teapot on the stove so she could drink it later. So we would put the teapot in the sink, and the rings make it possible for you to turn this heavy teapot, or heavy comma, over and pour the water in. But there was a round lid on the comma that's also metal, and I had put it on the edge of the sink, and the comma was here, and apparently when I went to get the comma, I knocked the lid into the sink. Now, the lid was like this, and you would have assumed that when it went into the sink, it would go in this way, flat. But it didn't. It landed on its side, and it rolled across the sink to where that bowl was waiting.
Oh, jeez.
And it just touched it, dink, and fell over. But in the sink, there were now two teeny, tiny little pieces of ceramic from the bowl. I was horrified. It's like, I have just ruined my teacher's 300-year-old bowl. Because, you know, once it's broken, right? You can't pretend that it's perfect anymore. It survived 300 years until me. I'm dying a thousand deaths. I don't know what my teacher is going to do. You know, this, I've probably been with her about 10 years by that time. Is she going to cry? Is she going to tell me to leave, like, you know, this woman, you know, I'm so clumsy, get out of here, you're a terrible student, how careless of you. What's she going to do? I don't know. I had mended many of her bowls before, but none of them were 300 years old either. So finally I had to go back into the tea room where she was sitting in her chair. And I had the bowl. I said, Peg, I've just done a terrible thing. I didn't mean to do it. I think I can fix it, but I've broken your bowl. And I handed it to her. She takes the bowl as if she has never seen it in her life. She's looking at it, and I'm standing there dying a thousand deaths, wanting to just disappear into the carpet, waiting for the inevitable. It probably was about 3 minutes. It felt like 3 hours. When finally, still holding the bowl, she looked up at me, because I was standing and she was sitting. It's in my mind perfectly still. And she said,
"These things happen."
These things happen? This was not what I was expecting at all. These things happen. Huh. I have been unpacking this for 20 years, 25 years almost, actually. I know how I felt at the time. I thought I knew what was going on, but actually, the longer I practice, the more I feel like I know that Peg is still teaching me. I really don't know what went through her mind in that 3 minutes or however long it was. But what she actually said came from an equanimity of body and mind that deeply understood something that I still did not understand really at the time. One thing in our lives is our relationship to each other. Things come and go, even valuable things. And they are really only as valuable as we believe them to be. I mean, witness an accident, and nobody got hurt, but see how upset people get. Oh, my brand new, MG is totaled, right? It's just a car. You walked out alive. Deep human connections are precious and getting, it seems, rarer all the time. But in that moment, Peg understood and unhesitatingly chose our relationship over her bowl. And you're probably thinking, well, of course she did. You were her tea student and her friend. But I don't know about the rest of you. Long experience with other humans has shown me that most people are not so forgiving or understanding in the first moments after a perceived catastrophe. In the heat of the moment, we yell, we blame, and inevitably we say things that we regret later. And we may apologize, but the harm will already have been done in our words and our deeds. Peg, you see, while looking at that bowl, allowed her mind and her body to settle. As she gazed at it, she probably went deep inside with her breath, came back and came back and came back until she could answer me with the depth of her love. Really, with long years of practice, like I said, by that time she was probably in her late 80s, so she had been practicing for 40 years at that point, tea and zazen. She did not allow her attachment to that bowl or anything else get in the way of her love for me. The interesting thing is, I knew her well enough. She wasn't angry. She wasn't disappointed. She wasn't even sad. And she also did not try to make me feel better. She didn't say, "Oh, it's okay, it's just a bowl." Because that also would have been inauthentic. She was absolutely and completely there with me and understood that I was in anguish and was trying to relieve that. She merely stated the truth of the situation. These things happen. 20 years later, fast forward, I am writing a book about my tea teacher, about Zen practice, about tea. And at one point, that wonderful comma that I had taken into the kitchen, that brazier was supposed to come to me, according to my teacher. But in the last 3 months of her life, her son came to visit. And when she told him that she intended to give that to me, he said, "No, oh, Mom, no. I wanted to take the brazier home." He lived in Hawaii. And put up a scroll and the brazier and a tea bowl with the things to remind me of you. Now, Peg felt pretty badly. I said, "Peg, no, this is your son. Of course, that's the perfect thing for him to do." So he packed up 4 boxes of tea things, including the brazier, and took them home to Hawaii. Well, knowing I'm writing this book, I thought it'd be really nice to have a photograph of that brazier because it was very unique. The comma, where the water is, had Chinese characters embossed on the outside. And the characters read, "Tea makes good friends." So I thought, wouldn't it be lovely for this to be part of the book, right? For people to be able to see what I'm talking about. So I wrote him. I said, "You know, is there any chance that you could take a photograph of the brazier?" He calls me back almost immediately. And this is somebody I haven't talked to in at least a year or two. Calls me, he says, "I can't take the photograph." It's like, "Really? Why?" He says, "Oh, well, you know, I brought all that stuff from my mom's, and it's been out in the garage for 20 years. I never unpacked it." "You never unpacked the brazier? It's in your garage for 20 years? And he says, "Yes, and I'm going to send it all back to you." It's like, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, wait a minute." He says, "There's 4 big boxes." I said, "Don't you want to go through the boxes and at least look and see what's in there?" "Nope. Nope," he said, I packed everything with too many styrofoam peanuts. It would make a mess. I don't want to open them up. I'm just going to send it all to you." 2 weeks later, sure enough, 4 boxes this big show up in my living room. It's like Christmas in July. All of these things from Peg's house that I hadn't seen in 20 years. A beautiful golden Buddha, a red lacquer tray that we used to use for tea, for tray service. Unbelievable stuff. But then, the brazier, I open it up. So there's the comma that holds the water, there's the brazier part with the heating element, but underneath the heating element inside is like a terracotta dish that holds the heating brazier, and naturally, it's broken. It's like, okay, already broken. However, at some point, I find this box. Now, Peg had a back room that she stored a lot of other treasures that I think we only saw maybe once or twice in my entire time of being with her over, you know, 15 years. This one in her beautiful kindergarten teacher script says, "Early Yuan, circa 1300, Chinese." It was bad enough that I broke her 300-year-old bowl. This is from 1300. This belongs in a museum. So I open it up because I don't know what's in here. I don't remember exactly. It's a bowl, a tea bowl. And the amazing thing is, somewhere along the way, this bowl got broken. But you can see that it has been mended with gold. This is a traditional Japanese art called kintsugi, where you take the broken pieces and you put them back together with gold. So I'm thinking to myself, here it is again, already broken. These things happen, especially to something that old. And yet, don't you actually think it's more beautiful with the gold?
Yeah.
This is the beauty of things that break. When we mend them, sometimes that actually makes them more beautiful and more precious to us, and we appreciate them more. And so I've been thinking a lot about this. In a sense, we are all broken bowls. There are things in us that are broken. And if we're lucky, someone comes along in our life who understands the art of human kintsugi. Because the only way to mend humans is with love. That is our gold. And on that day that I broke Peg's bowl, she mended something in me that I didn't even know was broken. She filled the cracks and the flaws in me with the simple vastness of her love, her compassion, and her wisdom, born of 45, 50 years of doing this thing that we are doing. It doesn't just happen, you know. You have to do a little work for it. So I asked at the beginning, upon what do we rely? This is what we rely on. When we know that the world is already broken, that everything we cherish, the people we're eventually going to be taken away from us. If we're lucky, we get to live to an old age. But I have so many friends who are living to an old age and their bodies are not cooperating. It's a misery for them. So we try to keep our bodies in as good a shape as we can, but eventually the body wears out. This is what the Buddha really understood. The body wears out. Already broken. And these things are going to happen. They are going, most of you are so young, you don't know this yet. I felt invincible in my 30s, 40s, even into my 50s. It was only in my 60s that I began to notice I didn't have quite as much energy. And now I am 70. And I am still in very good shape. But I know all my friends who are in their 80s and 90s, they are not in such good shape. And so I'm working very hard to stay in good shape. But it's a losing battle. The body falls apart. So what can we rely on? Impermanence. Okay, there are these three marks of existence. The first is that dukkha, the unsatisfactory. We just know that we're never completely ever going to be satisfied with anything. There's always going to be this longing for something else until we begin to look at it and see it. And then maybe we get a little release from it. The second one is impermanence. Well, you can see that for yourself. You are no longer 10 years old. You have changed, and everything has changed around you. And then there's this thing that we call emptiness, or boundlessness, as it was in the sutra this morning. This is the truth that nothing has a permanent, abiding nature moment after moment. You are different now than when you walked into this room. Things have happened in your body. You've heard something. We've shared this space. You are different. And if everything is in dynamic motion, then the only thing we can actually rely upon is this moment, right here, right now, and we bring to it all of our love, our compassion, our wisdom, everything we have, we bring it to this moment. What we can rely upon instead of sinking into the mud of samsara? Repentance, forgiveness of ourselves as well as others for being human. We will make mistakes. That is how we learn. Things will break. That's a given. The question is then, what are you going to do next? Thank you. So I have no idea if there's any time or if we need to stop. Mm-hmm.
Okay, would you entertain some questions?
If you have questions or you want to tell me a story about brokenness, I'm wide open. Yeah, Ren.
I'm so happy I came today. I've been missing Jikoji for the last 6 weeks this summer. And I loved that part of mending with love, because it's so true. Mm-hmm. The more you practice, you know, the easier it is to be in the world a better person for me. That's how I become better. So I can, you know, but so I so appreciate you being here. But I have a story that I tell sometimes, because I'm a landscape gardener. I have a crew, and I had some new tools. I'm all excited about my new job and my people. And so anyway, he breaks the shovel, and the old me was like, you know, I was going to get angry. You know, it's like, But the new me was like, are you okay?
Exactly.
And I totally surprised myself. I'm like, oh, look at me. I'm growing up.
You have changed.
So thank you.
Oh, what a wonderful story. Yes. Yes, instead of going, oh my God, my shovel, you chose your friend and said, are you okay? What a difference in focus, right?
Yeah, thank you.
Great story, thank you. You don't ask something about, you can ask anything you want. So maybe you came with a question.
There's someone right there.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you for sharing the beautiful stories. Given that you've worked with children, I have a question about if there's any difference. When you have the intention of changing their behavior. So I think what your teacher said to you, albeit being very simple, made you kind of change your behavior over the last however decades, 20 years maybe. But I felt if I said the same thing to a child, it would probably not have had the same effect. It was one thing that if I could do it, as your teacher did, and that's my work. But also I have this doubt, I guess, that even if I did it, maybe it would not have like the same effect in the child. So I wonder if you can share some wisdom there. Thank you.
Great question. So I was a teacher for 33 years, age nursery through 14. And it's a progressive alternative school, and so we were not bound by a lot of the same rules and regulations that public school would have. We also developed very close relationships with our kids. They called us by our first name, which for other parents and children was like, why are they calling you by their first name? And it's like, well, because that lessens that boundary of us and them. And we never felt disrespected. But what I did find, I completely hear what you're saying. I think that in my case with Peg, she could feel my anguish and my remorse. And so for her to be able to say these things happened, she knew I had already suffered enough. Now, if you have a child who's just throwing things around and doesn't care, that's a little different. But every now and then a child would show up with a book, because I was the librarian. It was a teaching position. They all came to me during the week for read aloud and all of that. But they, you know, a child would come with a book that their dog had gotten. And depending, you know, if they just put it in the little book pile and didn't say anything, that was one thing. But if they came to me and they were all, oh, I'm so sorry, my dog, then I would be able to say that these things happen. Because I would know that the remorse and the anguish was already taken care of. With a child that's just being reckless, you have to do a little bit different. And because they have to understand that everything needs to be taken care of.
Thank you.
I want to share my own experience. I was that child when I was about 8 years old. And one noon, I broke my mom's favorite bone. She was having the snap. So maybe she was in a good mood. But I was so afraid of being beaten by her, I cried first. Yeah, I cried first after I broke the bone. And my mom heard the noise. She just took a look at and said, okay, that was fine. And that moment, it was only a relief for me because I was very young. I think, okay, today I was lucky, I'm lucky enough to get away from from being beaten by my mom. But years, I still remember that noon, that she chose me, not the bow. Yeah. So this feeling can change when you grow up, but you can remember something. Yeah.
So there's two things. First of all, you had already had your own remorse and worry and fear and all of that. And the second thing, as you say, she chose you. That is beyond a gift to anyone to be additional love. Your mother knew that you had already suffered, right? Why keep whipping, right, the child or the dog or whatever? We don't need to. This is that kintsugi of love. If someone's doing something reckless or unkind on purpose, then we need a different response. But if someone is truly remorseful, truly feeling terrible about what they did, you're right. That memory is going to stay with you, as mine has with me for 20 years. And so many things in my life have gotten broken. My T students have been careless. My Zen students have been careless. And you know, my first response is always, oh well, these things happen. And where did that come from? That came from Peg. And where did it come from with your mother? Your mother must have gotten that from someone. But if your parent is someone who has been punished, let's say, by their parent, you know, this is the problem for us about karma. It carries forward, which is why when I went out with the bull to Peg, I was so worried because my mother, when I broke something, was not so nice about it. And I was expecting that. And Peg was able to completely break through that for me. And able then to trust that maybe there is some kind of understanding out there that I didn't mean to do this. Maybe I was careless, I don't know. But accidents happen too. Already broken. I will tell you one funny little thing, and then we were at Tassajara, and I gave part of this talk there. I didn't realize this. By the next day, already broken, and these things happen, had become Tassajara memes. Everybody's saying them to each other, but give it a total Zen student response. The second to the last day I'm there, one of the young women staff members is going on a hike. And you're supposed to sign out so that you don't, because people have gotten lost. And her friend said, you did sign out, right? And she said, oh yeah, I signed out. And they turned her and said, because, you know, already dead. I said, wait a minute, how did we go from already broken to already dead? Anyway, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I wanted to share something when I heard the stories. So I used to be very mean, and if someone was late, I would say they're wasting my time. Later, I just become more peaceful. If someone's late, I would more care about what happened, or what did you go through. I hope everything is okay. But when facing other people are different. Like sometimes I do run out of my place, and some tenants were asking, can it be cheaper, or can it be, if I'm continue like, if they're making requests, or it can be cheaper, and they're asking, can I ask a parking lot, I give them parking lot, and they continue to tell me, oh, your place is too hot, I would say, you're welcome to leave, and I may not need you anything, but I want you to leave. So it's really come to people's ask. First time you compromise, second time I only allow two or three. If it is more, I hope that, I want to get rid of some of the mm-hmm. person like mm-hmm. try to ask so many times.
Yeah. Well, for some people, nothing is ever going to be right. Right?
Yeah.
That the unsatisfactoriness of their life spills over no matter where they go. There's nothing you can do about that. Right? Other than, as you know, you try to do a couple things, but if they just continue, at some point you know nothing. It's a black hole. There's nothing you can do. A teacher of mine once, I went and I was talking and I was complaining about one of my students, and she said, "Misha, it sounds like you're trying to fix her." I said, "Yes, it does sound that way, doesn't it?" And she said, "Don't you know, you can't fix anyone. You can hardly fix yourself." And I have looked at that over and over. You can try and offer things to people. You can try to make things right. But at some point, only that person can make things right for themselves. Right? You can make it hotter, you can make it colder, you can do, but in the long run, actually, their own feelings of unsatisfactoriness are just spilling out into their life, and you can't fix that.
Yeah, I was just talking about my self-attitude is, I can't be nice, but I can be very mean.
Yeah. No, Zen practice is not about being a rug. We're not about being, you know, laying myself out to be stepped on, no. But it is when we can be kind, when we can be compassionate. But at some point, everybody has to do their work. And you can't do it for them. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
There's one more down there.
Oh. Can you speak up? I'm a little bit deaf.
Yeah. I want to ask her follow-up question to the previous one.
Yes.
About the child doing things. If someone has done something very bad, has a pretty damaging consequence, and the person didn't show remorse or didn't even realize the consequence it is causing, what are you going to do to make them understand that everything should be taken care of?
We had to do this a lot. I mean, when you have teenagers especially, younger children, it's usually accidental. Older children start making decisions, and a lot of them are not good ones. And so what we did in that case, if we could, we would just sit down with that child and have a conversation about, do you realize what you just did? You know, to actually, you know, we started always in the sandbox with our nursery students. You know, "Johnny, how do you feel about Michael throwing sand in your face? Can you tell him that you didn't like that?" And so beginning to establish that your behavior has consequences, and they might not be good ones. So that by the time they get older and are starting to do things on purpose, like saying mean things to each other, then what we would do, you know, the kids were really good about coming to us. They knew they could trust us to help them. We didn't tell them, "You shouldn't do that." We would say, "Okay, well, let's have a class meeting about this. Or how about let's get you and that person together with me, and we'll talk about this." And so they have to understand the humanity of each other, that your words have consequences. This person has feelings. Right? And when you start to do that, compassion begins to arise of, okay, can you imagine what it would have been the other way around? What if this person had done that to you? Right? How would you feel about that? So we sort of take them through that whole process of empathy and compassion, and what ends up happening is they become a little wiser. So generally speaking, we were able, I mean, we had a temporary director for a while, and when the new director came in, he said to her, You know, I've worked at a lot of schools, but this, I have to say, I don't understand why, but there are no discipline problems at this school. And I think it's because we started in the sandbox, having them talk, learn how to use their words rather than throwing things at each other. And to begin to understand that that whatever you do affects everything else. So especially in an egregious situation, which we had a few, sometimes it required getting the whole class together, having a whole class discussion. They used to meet every day, but sometimes it was because of something like that. And if it didn't get resolved well in that time, we brought it up again the next day until everybody felt satisfied that everyone understood and would go forward with different behavior. So with children, what we're, in order to create mature adults, with children, we start very early doing what your experience was. We don't punish them, but we do talk to them about, okay, so, you know, that was a really valuable something or other that you just broke. How are you feeling about that? And how do you think I'm feeling about that? To allow them to take in that you, like the kid who has the temper tantrum and throws something and breaks it, you might be having feelings, but do you understand that other people are having feelings too? So that, you know, it ends up being about our precepts here about right speech, right action. That we start teaching those things. If we start early enough, by the time they get to be of the age of doing things on purpose, they probably won't, because they see that they have a larger effect. The difficulty, I think, for us in the world is a lot of adults, you know, there's a lot of children out there wearing adult suits, right? That's the way I think of it, who don't know how to handle their emotions, who don't understand that they're acting out, that their drama is affecting everything, and that they wonder why people don't want to be with them, right? It's like, well, because actions have consequences. This is what karma is about. So at my school, one of the reasons I worked at this school was I could practice my Buddhist practice right there, not in a really obvious way, but, okay, right speech, right action, right mindfulness, paying attention. Everything was accepted there as just part of the program. So I was very fortunate to have a job that worked well with my Zen practice, but I also feel like I brought my Zen practice to my job. So long answer, but
very nice. Do you want to just give anybody online have a question you'd like to ask? We're just about to close.
Okay.
One more, I think, and then we're done.
Oh, okay.
My question is about the metaphor you mentioned for the...
I'm sorry, it's about...
The metaphor.
Metaphor you mentioned about the Buddha's sculpture.
Yes.
Yeah. So, do you mean that... what we say and smell and taste and hear is not important?
No. It's all important.
It's all,
everything is equally important.
Why do you think it's a perfect broken?
So the difficulty for us is that we exist basically in two realms that support each other. There's the relative world, which is the one where you're going to have to get in your car and drive home. And if you don't pay attention to the red light, you're going to cause an accident.
Yeah.
Right? There's that.
Yeah.
Then there's what we call the absolute realm. And the absolute realm is where your individual I can drop away. You can't live there all the time, right? Otherwise you'll go through the red light. But when you're in Zazen, this can happen very naturally. You're still going to hear the bird, but you're not going to be disturbed by it. You're not going to start thinking, oh, what kind of bird is that? Oh, where is that bird? You're just going to hear it and go back to your breath. So the hearing is important, sight is important, so I can see all of you. But in Zazen, we're able to settle into the silence and enjoy that too, which normally in our lives we don't do, right? We're so busy doing. And this is the opportunity to exist in that sort of not doing place. And so when I said that it was perfect being able to see that, it's just that it's representing the world that normally, where did it go? That normally this is the thing that we think is everything, right? But it's not. It's part of everything. It's important for us to have eyes, ears, nose, mouth, all of that, because that's how we relate to the world. But it's also a wonderful thing to be able to let this go and experience the silence of the sort of universal consciousness, because you're bigger than you know. There's a part of you that belongs to everything, the universal consciousness. But normally we're so busy that we can't connect to that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so you mean like what we say here, smell, taste, live in this world but don't get attached to them?
Yeah, right, right. That these things are all, information is coming in all the time, right? And it's wonderful. I mean, we are so lucky to have these incredible senses. But we have another sense, this sixth sense, that we often don't pay attention to. And when we finally do shut up long enough and are in silence, things arise that are unexpected. So keep sitting and find that out for yourself. So I can talk about it all I want, but your experience of it is not mine. Right?
Do you mean that when we meditate, we can connect to the universal consciousness?
Yep, that's exactly what I mean. You get, when you finally settle down and things get quiet, it's always there. You're always connected, right? You can call it the Dharma, the Buddha, God, cloud of unknowing, whatever you want to call it. It's always there, that universal connection. But most of the time, the relative is getting in the way all the time of it.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jikoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jikoji, please visit us on the web at jikoji.org.